and welcome to Product Market Fit, a podcast for early stage founders all about startups, technology, and growth. I'm your host, Moshe Poltorek, and this week I have not just one amazing founder, but three. For our first panel style interview, I brought back three early guests to the show who are personal and fan favorites to give us an update on progress made and lessons learned from 2023. We've got Rafa Alstadt of TLDV, Pascal Weinberger of Bardeen.ai, and Jacob Knutzen of Butter. All three companies are prosumer type SaaS apps with a strong PLG or product-led growth motion, a topic we go deep into. All three companies expanded their AI offerings within the product this year, so we discuss the AI hype cycle, EAC versus DCEL debate, and regulation. And somewhat coincidentally, all three founders are based in Europe, so we talk about what's happening in the European startup community and funding, regulation, etc. Make sure to stay to the end when Rafa, Pascal, and Jacob share their bold 2024 predictions. I was really excited to catch up with these three, and they didn't disappoint with their thoughtful and honest responses. Many great takeaways here, so stay tuned. And please shoot me a quick note at hello@pmfpod.com if you like this panel-style interview. I may do more of these in the future. Now, onto the show. Hello, happy new year. Welcome, everybody. So happy to do this. Great to see you again.
Excited to be here.
Happy new year.
Hey, everyone.
Happy New Year.
Very good. So for those that may not know you guys, if each of you can do a real quick intro, what do you guys do and a little bit about your company?
Okay, I can start out real quick. So my name is Jacob. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Butter, which is like Zoom, but laser focused on workshops and training.
Awesome. Rafa?
Hi, I'm Rafa, co-founder and CEO of TLDV. We are AI to summarize your Google Meet, Zooms, and Teams, and push the takeaways into your favorite productivity app and so much more.
Fantastic. And Pascal?
Yes. Pascal, co-founder, CEO of Bardeen. We're a workflow automation app trying to make automating your workflow super easy and accessible to everyone.
Amazing. So it's coincidental, actually, that you're all European founders. And the other connection that I realized, the three of you are all Product Hunt Golden Kitty Award winners. So I don't know what to make of that, but there's some cosmic connection here. Let's look back on 2023. Something that I have taken from Jesse Pooji, who was on the show back in the summer, and he told me this idea of high-low buffalo, something I do with my kids every week now. So it's a highlight, something that maybe didn't go as planned or a challenge. And then buffalo could be anything random, funny, whatever it is. So each of you, I guess we'll go in reverse order this time, high-low buffalo from 2023.
High for us for 2023 was definitely launch of our Magic Box feature. That was the most exciting thing I think we did. For the ones who don't know, it's basically like lets you automate any workflow with pure text. So it's like taking this idea that obviously with ChatGPT, the whole world talked about natural language processing and so on. So we took this idea into the automation universe. And we were the first ones to launch this text to automation feature, if you will. There was a lot of fundamental research and development that went into that since the starting of the company, actually. And that was a big highlight for us to launch that. And it was very well received and one of the most exciting features in the platform. I would say that as our highlight. The low, on the other hand, it's a very crowded market. You mentioned before, like we're all kind of PLG companies, so I'm sure we'll have a conversation around this. But something that we're still learning to do is, how do we stick out? How do we separate ourselves from the noise? How do we differentiate ourselves as a product? And I think it's an interesting thing that almost every user or power user, especially that we have on the platform, they're like, hey, if you guys only did like a better job at like messaging and positioning, and you would talk about all the, you know, great things that the platform can do and the power of it and so on, it would be so much easier for people to find and to discover you guys versus, I think we have a big mismatch between how we talk about us and how we position it and what it can actually do. So that's a big thing we're learning. Buffalo, we had some really like fun random encounters. One was, partnership with HubSpot we did that was completely random. There's some funny stories of how that came to be. And that would be my buffalo.
Okay. And by the way, if you want to throw in personal anecdotes, you can as well. It doesn't have to just be about your startup, but that's great. And I do remember you talking about the generative AI feature back when we met in December of 22. So I know that's something that you had planned a while back and didn't just cram into the product afterwards to ride the wave. So congrats on launching that. I'm glad that the reception was good. Rafa?
Cool. I love them. So now I feel I should share also something personal. Let me share both actually. So like high, definitely had a strong growth in all our numbers, including monetization and revenue. We managed to kind of hit the monetization path that is successful for us. Another high in my private life, I reconnected with someone super important to me personally, which I'm very happy about. The first thing comes to mind is we didn't manage to get our team together last year. A lot of like things happened. People were sick or occupied, you know, but it's planned now in April. So finally looking forward. On the other side, super cool how much we managed to innovate and do and launch and stick together despite not meeting in person once last year. But still, like, we can do much better. And the Buffalo, I started posting on LinkedIn more and really enjoyed. I don't know. It's not a pro. It's not a con. I'm not going viral, but I have some fun there. So is that a proper Buffalo? I hope so.
There's no right or wrong answers. I love it. Thanks for sharing that.
Cool. Yeah, I think professional high was definitely starting to land medium-sized corporate customers, landing our first 50-seat organization. That was pretty cool. We've since then landed several larger double-digit seat organizations, which is super cool for a product like ours, like especially coming from a PLG, you know, prosumer path and seeing that, okay, you can actually go into these large customers and get adopted. That was big, big wins on our side. And a personal high would be the birth of my son in August, which is like mind-blowing, awesome, amazing. And I've just been filled with joy ever since.
Congratulations. That's amazing news. Is your first child?
Yep.
Mazel tov. Welcome to the club.
Cheers, man.
That's great.
Low would be market is tough. We have not hit our monetization trajectory, and that has meant cash constraints and us having to let go of people. So the actual low would be that we had to let go of several people. That was rough. Sucks, right? Being smart and tell the people go that you'd rather keep. So definite low. Buffalo would be like, we launched a lot of random features in Butter because we like having the fun with the product. So I guess those are some of the Buffaloes. I can't even remember all the random features we launched. And a personal Buffalo would be me getting really into cooking and sous videing stuff and all kinds of things, which you're supposed to do as a dad.
Awesome. So we talked a little bit already about AI and some of the features that you've released in your respective products. Of course, 2023 was the year of AI in many ways, and so many companies have launched, and there's a lot of hype around it. Tell me, from your perspective, AI hype, is it raging? Are we still in the early innings of the hype cycle? Is it dying down a little bit? How are you thinking about it today as we're going into 2024? Rafa, if you want to start us off.
Definitely, it's here to stay, like, even on the signals we see in our, like, for example, I can speak about our product, but also my usage of several products, not in our niche, that this is going to stay very, very relevant. I think now the question is more about, like, how can you communicate the biggest value add to a larger group of people? And maybe this goes a little bit into what Pascal was hinting at in some way as well. Because I feel like there's a lot of companies right now slapping a ton of AI into their product, and that gets kind of bloated, you know? And so I can't wait for this year to kind of see, like, when really, like, the dust settles. But then I think it will even supercharge the adoption even more.
Yeah, I think that we're seeing that as consumers of other products, that you can tell the difference of whether AI is core to making the product better, adding value, or making the user experience better, or if it's slapped on in order to increase your valuation when fundraising. There's a right way to do it and a wrong way, right? Not everybody should be doing AI.
I think there's a few different elements here also. Like, one is on the fundamental model level, I think, where we saw the most hype, I would say, last year. Companies raising billions to train language models. I'm not certain that will continue. We've lived through a cycle like this with computer vision a couple of years ago, where there was like billions and billions poured into computer vision models. And then where it settled now is you have the big hyperscaler cloud companies that virtually for free offer computer vision models. And then you have very specialized model companies that do, you know, computer vision for fashion, quality control, you name it. But they don't require these huge models. And I think that's would be my bet. You know, obviously no one really knows how the future plays out, but I think that we'll see a similar trend with language models, where you will have these giant models that you still get on, you know, AWS, GCP, your favorite cloud provider, whatever. And there may or may not be a few independent players. And I'm not sure if you want to count like OpenAI or Anthropic even as independent at this point, because they're basically integrated into the hyperscalers. But I don't think there's going to be much need for many more base models. And then we will see smaller models that are much more specialized, thinking about, you know, applications in legal tech, medicine, you know, special translations, politics, you name it, consulting, that there'll be kind of, I think, more specialized models that they don't need billions in funding. I think that would be kind of my prediction for that. However, on the consumer side, I'm pretty optimistic. I think there's some really strong signals, kind of similar to what Raf said before. Like, I also see myself using more and more AI features of other products on a regular basis, not only to play around with them, obviously. That's still a big aspect of it, but also like just on a regular basis. I think especially the search world is completely reinvented at this point. I think we'll see that growing. And I think a few interesting signs are even that, like, I'm sure you guys heard about this, like Microsoft, for their new hardware, that they're releasing a new computer and that will actually have a new key, right? Like Microsoft has this like Windows key, and then they're now introducing a physical key on the keyboard for their AI Copilot feature. Like, that's just kind of like a manifestation of like how important of a feature they see that being in the future. Otherwise, they wouldn't add a key on the keyboard, which obviously just adds clutter and so on. So I think that we will see a much stronger adoption, especially in enterprise larger companies, of like critical AI features and infrastructure.
Are they finally laying Cortana to rest? Are they still trying to do that?
That I have no idea.
You mentioned the foundational models. These companies that we saw last year raise enormous amounts of money with valuations that we haven't seen in a while, right? Anthropic and, of course, OpenAI and Mistral and some others. Is there any way that they grow into those valuations? Or
yeah,
you think so?
Yeah, OpenAI, it's now public numbers, right? $1.6 billion in revenue per year. And their valuation was what, like $80 billion? So, I mean, that it's high multiples, but it's not insanely high multiples.
But won't the monetization drop as it gets commoditized?
That's the interesting thing. Like, people always think commoditized technology is hard to monetize, yet the biggest companies in the world by revenue are commodity companies, electricity, water, supply, you name it. I think like as technology commoditizes, being one of the big suppliers actually will boost your monetization. You may not have as much margin power and things like that, right? Because the differentiation is harder. But I think precisely because models will commoditize and we will see them everywhere, the revenue of those fundamental model companies will continue growing. I think, obviously, hard to predict the future, but, you know, similar to, you might make a point that like cloud technology is commoditized, yet there's like, I think Amazon with hundreds of billions in revenue, and then a few other players with tens of billions in revenue, and then nothing. So I think we'll see a similar landscape in a few years for base models.
Fair enough. What about the EAC versus DCEL debate that's going on? We'll start with Jacob. Where do you stand on this raging war of acceleration versus doomism? And I guess, how does regulation fit into that as well? Any thoughts on that?
I'd start to caveat it with the fact that I don't have super strong opinions on this. I think you can get, like, you can really rabbit hole on that debate, just spend hours and hours thinking about stuff instead of doing stuff. I think the thing that I'm personally the most worried about is that we'll see a world where that debate drives Europe in one direction and, say, the US in another direction. And as a European founder, that scares the shit out of me and worries me that we'll be left behind even more than we already are. That's probably like my biggest concern with this particular debate and the direction it's heading. That Europe will go into a too strong regulatory direction. Like, I do think that regulation is necessary and wished for here, but I also think it's super difficult. And that the US will, as we've seen so many times, go into an acceleration direction. And the winds will favor the US significantly more than Europe here.
Mm-hmm. But you don't buy into either extreme, that on the one hand, AI is the savior and we're approaching AGI or singularity. On the other hand, that it is a mortal threat to humanity and we need to stop it and rethink our approach to exploration. You're not taking either
action. I know it's super soft to just say, I'm a nice middle of the road kind of guy, right? And of course, I'm more an optimist when it comes to the AI stuff, right? That being said, like, I do think that as with so many other areas, like regulation is necessary and wished for, but I also think it's freaking difficult and I don't see any of the directions that we've seen on a regulatory perspective here lead us in a direction that this really is positive. On top of that, I'd also say that I do not fundamentally believe in a fragmented regulatory world when it comes to this stuff. Like, kind of part of the world regulating it, another part not regulating it. Well, okay, maybe you can have China doing whatever they want, right? But at least the US and Europe, that level of a divided world will be extremely difficult when it comes to this level of technology, way more difficult than we've seen on, say, privacy issues. And I don't know where that'll end.
I think it's actually like an interesting issue that a lot of people who think that AI is a fundamental threat to humanity push so hard for regulation, because I think, like, if you were to believe that it's true that, like, it becomes the most powerful weapon humanity has ever built and so on, then you regulating it in your own country doesn't protect you from the global humanitarian threat that it may or may not pose, right? Like, I think it's a fundamentally flawed reaction to any sort of belief system you may have. So, you know, I'm on Jacob's side here, like, you know, born in Europe, live in Europe now. I don't think it's a smart move. I think regulation is important, and it is important to especially regulate the uses of technology and the training data and, like, privacy aspects of it. But I think there's also, you know, as always, there's a spectrum. And I think, like, with the recent EU proposal or, you know, regulation implementation, I think we've gone way too far on the, like, hardcore regulation side versus the, like, okay, you want to regulate, you know, the basics of it and create some safety mechanisms, but you want to leave room for experiments and improvements. Because honest reality is that, like, no one really knows how this technology will work, you know, 2, 3, or even 10 years from now. 10 years from now is completely impossible to predict. Even 2 years ago, like, things looked very different than what we have today. Like, I think most people 2 years ago wouldn't predict that we have such a large scale distribution of AI systems that we already have today. So I think, like, the pace of innovation is insane here, and it's hard to predict. And being so strong and over-regulating almost, I think you just shoot yourself in the foot, and you create, like, a huge competitive disadvantage to your country, to your companies, researchers, universities, everyone in the ecosystem. And we already see that a bunch of, like, in historical times, like, you know, with things like GDPR and so on for machine learning systems, which already have been an issue, you know, pre-large language models, you just go somewhere else. Like, the companies, it's not that people who really want to work on this, they now, because regulators say, like, you can't do it, they decide not to work on it. They just go somewhere else. Like, I've seen some of the best researchers, without naming people, but they were working at institutions like the Research Institute for Artificial Intelligence in Germany, like the DFKI, and they're now in China doing research, being very well funded by the government and not having to deal with all the regulatory issues that you have here. So I think it's you just weaken the ecosystem here. And because I think there is a real risk of negative abuse of AI technologies, as, by the way, there is with any other technology, I think it's important to be in a leadership position and have the latest tools and latest technology to be able, in the worst case, to counteract any threat that may be posed by it. And I think, like, Europe just did the exact wrong thing to do there. So I don't know, it'll be interesting to see, but yeah.
That's the biggest gap in the debate for me, is that regardless of where you stand on it, you can't regulate the globe. So no matter what you do in the US or Europe, China or whoever else will do what they want. So I don't know what's the practical use of these types of deceleration type regulation. Of course, safety is important, and we need to consider secondary and tertiary effects of any new technology. And I understand that some of it is being driven by regulatory capture, but I think that a lot of it is just driven by pessimism and fear-mongering, which I don't like in general. I try to usually take the side of the optimists. Rafa, any thoughts on this one?
No, I fully agree. I'm, like, so mad at being a German founder in Europe, dropping the ball here, to be honest. I'm glad that we all agree on this topic. Yeah, what is there to do, you know? Like, I just think, keep moving and hope that somehow they wake up. I think most of the stuff has been said already, and I signed everything you said.
So let's continue picking on European regulators for a second. And I don't know if you even consider UK European anymore.
They've taken their stance, you know?
They've taken their stance, right? You don't mind them. They've self-selected out, right? The UK antitrust regulator essentially killed the Adobe Figma deal. It was a massive exit for Figma, and it got essentially blocked, and it was announced that the deal would be canceled. Do you think that this is a significant blow to the startup community? You're each founders, you think about, maybe not every day, but you think about your exit opportunities, and you're building something in order to eventually, you know, you've taken outside money, you've taken venture money, there needs to be an exit. Does this change how you think about your exit path, and how does this affect the startup community?
Initially, this was my reaction, but then actually I changed my perspective pretty fast on it. It's two major players in the market, with Adobe being historically like a very dominant one, and then Figma becoming like the new age favorite tool of choice. And so I think that, you know, it can be very healthy for the ecosystem if there's two strong players instead of one giant. And so I actually don't think that this is, I think it's actually creating a lot of like opportunities. Like the market will likely grow in the future a lot still, and then there's room for more players. It's just a really large scale acquisition, so I think it made sense that they ruled it like that.
Yeah, I think it's also like we're all better off for it, I think, at the end of the day. At least from what I mean, obviously it sucks kind of being founding team of a company like that, and then you get accustomed to the idea. I'm sure they've made arrangements, changes, decisions based on this, to then kind of have to go back on it. I think like the net outcome, probably Dylan and his team are better off being a standalone company. I know they've grown a lot since the acquisition was announced to it being killed. I know like they did very strong. They announced some cool stuff. They're still growing. We're still using, like most people I know still are using Figma, and it's only growing. So I think they'll look back on it in a few years, maybe possibly after an IPO, and they'll be happy that they didn't, you know, sell themselves out cheap.
Well, the $1 billion breakup fee helps, right? Softens the blow.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like, I think there is something to be said about the power that regulators have in it, especially in relatively small markets like the UK and Figma, not even being a butch company. And, you know, there's this whole question about like how much say should they have in the first place, and who should actually, like from a regulatory perspective, make a decision like this. You know, what if some random, you know, I mean, I'm in Switzerland right now, so I'll just say this, right? But like, what if some random small country like Switzerland suddenly decides to kill a deal? Like, does this actually blow up the bigger deal or not? Like, I think there's all this kind of like weird uncertainties that come from this. Usually, like we've gone through an interesting process this year with some very similar experiences, and usually these like breakup clauses are more of a like, oh, it'll never happen anyways, and like, you know, regulators will approve anyways. I think that people will consider that now in a different way. I think that will net be, you know, negative impact to the startup ecosystem, just because there's now an additional risk factor in these decisions and transactions that traditionally wasn't as big of a risk factor. So yeah, I don't know. I think like regulators in general should maybe like think about the long-term consequences of what the actions are they doing, right? Like we just talked about the AI regulation. I think they're also like, it's a, obviously I think the intention behind it is good. Like no one, I don't think they're making this to destroy the startup ecosystem, but you know, there may be an unintended long-term consequences that maybe they should be thinking about a little bit more before they make such decisions.
Sure.
Just one thing on the regulator side. I mean, the biggest thing there was the Activision Blizzard and Microsoft deal. I don't know how much you followed that, right? But it was like, again, the Microsoft's trying to acquire Activision Blizzard for like, was it a year and a half or 2 years, something like that, since they announced, till it actually went through. And that was also the UK regulators that held up the deal there. So I think that with several like big deals like this being held up in the UK, I think that will have to happen some stuff on UK antitrust regulation scene, or some self-reflection there, or some changes there. So I think we'll be seeing some changes from that perspective. I think secondly, the deal was humongous. And even today, it's like, it was crazy. Wasn't it like 50x AR or something like that valuation, right? I mean, yeah, Figma's growing impressively, but that's kind of baked into that insane multiple, right? So it was kind of crazy deal. Like, let me say, if I get a 50x AR acquisition off of today, you know, I consider it. So there's something interesting there. I think to your original question, Moshe, like on us thinking about whether this changes anything on our acquisition side or our potential exit side, I honestly, like, potential exits is not something that I ruminate over on a daily basis. And like when I dream big, it's always the IPO, right? And I guess many of us do that automatically when we kind of start something and think it could be really, really cool, right? Even though it sounds absurd when you're sitting in the earlier stages of the company, I guess that's kind of what you really, really want. So, yeah.
Yeah. If you're building, may as well build big, right? I think you bring up really good points. I don't know enough about how the measurement of market dominance and competitiveness is calculated to understand whether or not, Rafa, to your point, it was the right thing to do to block it. But I think that two things are clear to me. Number one, the UK is potentially putting themselves at a disadvantage to try to be, maybe they're trying to be relevant, whereas, you know, they're the smallest of the three. If you think of the regulatory bodies in Europe and US and UK, they're the smallest of the three and they're trying to make the most noise. And it may just mean that companies just try to avoid nexus with them and they get excluded entirely. The other thing that I think is just the timing is terrible. If you're going to block it, do it quicker. Nobody needs to be in limbo for 15, 18 months trying to have two separate plans and roadmaps. And it's not a way to run a company. It's not a way to build. Figma did an amazing job continuing to grow and continuing to ship during that time. But as Pascal mentioned, like there's certainly many decisions that were on hold or had to be undone because they were in this limbo state. So regulatory bodies out there listening, just move faster. If you're going to do something, do it quicker, right? Since we're talking about Europe and you guys are all in Europe, what else is happening? Any trends that you're seeing? Anything that we should pay attention to in terms of the European tech and startup community and or with the funding landscape? I know we probably talked about it the first time that I interviewed you specifically about your fundraising journey and the difference between European and US investors. But has anything been changing? Any trends that you want to bring up? I guess, Jacob, if you want to share your perspective first, and we'll go around.
Sure. Europe is, like, I don't know whether this is your experience as well, guys, but Europe has, to me at least, traditionally been over-indexing on metrics very early on, whereas the US have been like big picture vision shared and like really, really out there. And I have a feeling that with the crunch that we've seen now, a lot of European investors have kind of just defaulted back to being, oh yes, I was right to initially just focus on all the metrics and let's do CAC LTVs on pre-seed companies again, right? So there's been a drive to conservatism, I think, which was incredibly unhealthy for the European funding ecosystem. So that's kind of one of the things that I've heard quite a few places. I think that one of the good things that happened during COVID was a big cross-pollination of the European and US fundraising ecosystems. And the US investors still seem to be as hungry to invest in European companies as ever. So I think that, that's probably something we'll be seeing more of in the future if European VCs and investors continue to be a bit too early stage data focused compared to earlier.
Yeah, I agree. I think we've all seen the reports like startup failures go up, but that's global as well. But like, I think in Europe, it hurts a bit more. My opinion, new startups being founded went down drastically. And like, also if you look at like where the money is coming from that fund startup, it's like, even like within Germany, it's like a lot of it is coming from the US. I would love to see a more healthy engine within Germany, for example, speaking about that. I think France is doing incredibly well. I think they're a good benchmark. UK to some extent more, but like Germany itself right now is just like terrible. I know what Pascal thinks about that, but I'm like not a fan.
Yeah. I have to admit, I'm not too active in Europe myself. Like, I think most of our investors are American. We've never, like, I never considered us like a German or a European company for that sake. We have most of our team in the US and so on. And that's by design, right? It's like, why would you pick a harder market? Like, if you can relatively easily pick an easier playing field, right? So like, I tend to agree. I think there's a lot of homework to be done in Europe in general in the startup ecosystem. Some factors were mentioned before. Like, I think we need a bit more of this like think big mentality to really make, you know, step function changes. There's some small improvements here and there, right? Like, I mean, there's the occasional like quantum computing company that gets funded in Germany and so on, but like a rocket company, but the scales are just too small, I think, to really make a difference. But then at the same time, it's hard to like kickstart this. I think like the US has a huge advantage just by the sake of that they have a, you know, very strong venture ecosystem since, you know, decades at this point that keeps feeding in itself, right? Like, most of the big funds are started by ex-entrepreneurs that have successfully, you know, bought their companies public or acquired with big acquisitions. So they have new money that then gets fed back into the ecosystem. Some of that happens in Europe already. Like, I know a lot of the, like, you know, successful founders, they do a lot of angel investing. They do, you know, some of which have started funds. You know, they're obviously smaller now. They haven't been able to grow over the last 20 years. But I think there's some of it already happening. Maybe this is something where regulators could make it more attractive. give tax write-offs, give like tax incentives to do things like that, enable more lean structures for fundraising. Like, I mean, Germany, one of my favorite examples is like, even if you want to raise a seed money, like, you know, you're trying to raise a few $100,000 for your seed, like you end up having to deal with all this like notary stuff and wet signatures for everything. And it's just really painful to do, like, versus in the US, like you can incorporate and raise millions without ever having to step foot in any lawyer's office or notary's office. And I think that just like removes friction from the process, right? Like if you're trying to, as with everything, if you're trying to scale something, the best way to scale is like remove friction from every step of the process. And I think that's maybe something where, like, yes, it's the ecosystem itself. So like founders who have access, like keep reinvesting in it. That's already happening. I think we see a lot of that. That just needs time. But then there are some things where maybe, you know, regulators could be a bit more active in removing friction from it, and policymakers.
Well, to correct you, the regulators are very active right now.
Just in the wrong way, right? I think there's a big difference there, though, within Europe. Like in Denmark, it's very easy to set up a company. It's very easy to fundraise. So you don't have all the wet signature, a ton of digital signature stuff. Where we see issues is very much in like importing. Like now we're a fully remote company, but if you were to start a Danish company, actually have employees in Denmark. Immigration is absolutely horrible. And then taxation issue. We have a huge lot of taxation issues on employee stock options and stuff. It just makes it incredibly difficult to compensate employees with stock options, and therefore makes it very difficult, makes it very expensive to have early stage employees, and makes it very hard to reward risk-willing employees. So there's a lot of this stuff that's just tougher. One thing I would say, though, that I think is almost even bigger than the VC issues are like founder mentality issues in Europe, and it's the perspective of failure. I still think we're so far off, like decades off of the acceptance of founder failure that you see in the US, where I see a lot of founders that fail and they pick themselves up and boom, onward to the next one, right? And that causes, I think, founders to stick to businesses that aren't working for too long. Right. So they keep otherwise talented founders that I've seen working on stuff that they should have shut down a long time ago. And once you fail, like, oh, I need half a year or a year to decompress because that shit was just tough. And there's so much stigmatization from families and friends and stuff like that. I don't know whether that's the same, but I'd imagine it's the same in Germany as in Denmark. And I think across Europe, there's a lot of stuff that could really use a boost.
I appreciate the nuance. You know, as someone sitting in the US, may think about Europe as kind of this one homogenous thing. And, you know, US folks are known to be a little US centric and not necessarily thinking about the nuances that exist elsewhere. So just to remember that Europe, yes, there is the EU, but every country has its own set of regulations, norms, and practices that may differ from country to country. Really good point there. Anything else to add before I want to shift to talking about PLG?
From my side, the high hopes on Mistral in this sense, like that's the, I think the most, or at least as of my knowledge, the one that I've seen and got some like results that I actually found like relatively promising.
In terms of fundraising or just in general?
Just in general, like I think it's like I bank on it, hoping it will yield something for Europe at large.
Yeah. I think the Aleph Alpha, I think also was probably one of the biggest fundraisers in Europe recently, right? Very cool. So each of your companies, each of your products relies on a PLG or product-led growth motion. For just a kind of a quick intro to what that means, basically people are self-directed into starting to use the product and eventually to monetize within the product, as opposed to a sales-led motion where it's much more top-down. And of course, there's shades of gray and overlap where there's product-led sales and sales-assisted PLG and all, every flavor in between. So for each of your companies and your growth strategies and what you've tried in 2023, if you can share any learnings, experiments, or insights as relates to that. Pascal, since you brought it up earlier and you had a lesson learned on that, if you want to start us off.
PLG is a really powerful machine because you have to necessarily be super close to your users. I think like one of my previous company, we were doing like more B2B enterprise sales. And an interesting thing there was like, obviously like you get a few million in revenue way faster than you do with traditional PLG motions. but you can also have a lot lower quality product doing so, because like the people who sign the deal and wire the money aren't necessarily your users, right? Like you typically sell into some sort of executive in a company, and then they oftentimes, like if anything, get an admin dashboard of the product and like some sort of like fancy graphs, but like the end user of your product is someone else, right? Versus with PLG, you fundamentally have to optimize for the end user experience. And I think that's a great forcing function, which like all the PLG companies you see out there, and I think that's certainly true for, at least like I know TLDB quite well as a user also in Butter too, it almost like forces you to build a better version of the product. So that's amazing. On the other side, you know, you're kind of usually by definition talking to people with lower budgets. You know, people have sometimes their own personal credit card that they put in, or they have to go expense it, which a lot of people aren't really like excited to do. So on the monetization front, it's much harder to like hit monetization, like really hit big numbers in monetization. So this kind of comes as a two-sided coin, as you know, everything in life. The advantage I think with it is at a certain point in time, and we spent the first 2 years building like a free, basically free to use version of our product, precisely because we acknowledged that like, okay, we have to build the best possible user experience, make it super seamless to use, accessible for everyone, and then slowly added monetization on top of it. Which now kind of puts us in a situation where we now have to think about like, what's the next step, right? Like, how do you now get away from like people's personal credit cards and them expensing the motion to something that looks a lot more like a enterprise motion without necessarily having to do this top-down enterprise element. So, and there's many different approaches people have done, right? Like there's the sales assist, there's kind of like product qualified leads, and then you build a sales motion on top of it where you have people that have lots of like strong user bases inside your product, and then those you target with a traditional sales motion, or you try to create like upgrade paths within the product that encourage your users to become your salespeople, essentially to pitch the product usage to the executives and then get them to, you know, become the billing admin, if you will. So that's still something that I think like the whole industry is kind of figuring out. We talked to a lot of PLG companies who've done this successfully, from Notion, Calendly, you name it. And at least I haven't found like a perfect blueprint on like, here's the proven path of doing this. I think everyone agrees that like you have to, you know, build it into the product, make it a, you know, easy to use, seamless experience within the product. But then how exactly the mechanics work of, you know, unlocking this almost like team or collaborative motion in your product, that's something that there's many ideas out there. And I think everyone kind of has to test this for themselves. And we're kind of going through this right now ourselves. We've just launched a team version of Badin, so you can now collaborate with your team on it. And we're kind of trying to figure out how to make this work as a bottom-up PLG sales motion to scale across an organization.
I appreciate that. Are any of you using Pocus to help with product-led sales?
Last year, I went through looking at both Pocus, Endgame, and a ton of these different types of products. And as a pretty strong mixed panel and analytics user in general, I just found it too... Well, it's a dumbed down analytics suite, very focused on salespeople. I can see this if you're a big PLG organization like Loom or anything like that, then it would work. But if you're a smaller organization, then it seems like total overkill to have that and a, like we're using Mixpanel for our product analytics to have both of those.
Interesting. Well, we can continue around the horn about any insights about PLG in general and growth. And also, Jacob, I know that you guys do a reverse trial instead of a freemium or free trial. So maybe if you can talk about kind of the nuances there, if there's any insights to be gleaned from experimenting with those types of different type of trials.
Yeah, I mean, we can actually, like, so we actually started out having a reverse trial. And for context on that, it's basically just having both a freemium version and then upgrade automatically when people sign up, they automatically upgrade for 7-14 days to a paid version and then downgrade it again, right, to the freemium version at the end of that cycle. We started with reverse trial when we started monetization a bit back. Then we discontinued the reverse trial and just went freemium. And we reintroduced it because it just worked so much better with the reverse trial. So I don't know whether there are any big learnings on that, except it works. I would say the whole it works is just, I think we've done 6, 7, 8 price changes, or like changes on limits and everything, like and larger ones throughout this year alone. So it's something that we continuously test out on, like, does our freemium model have too much, too little? Like, when should we, like, we change from 14-day trial to 7-day trial with a 14-day. So you can do a number of, like, a checklist, and then you can extend your trial. And we've just seen, oh, hey, that's awesome. So this extended trial thing, it's really working. Anyone that completes that extended trial, they, like, I think we have a very high conversion rate of those to paid users. And many of those are also flagged as qualified leads for potential upsales for us.
Yeah, I remember that you guys, that was very unique about how you implemented it, creating those gamified mechanics of if you do X, Y, and Z, you extend your trial. And of course, the X, Y, and Z helps with activation because you're making them use the most valuable features of the product. I thought that was really, really smart. And I guess it works.
Yeah. Seems to work. And I think that the biggest thing there is actually this whole indication of the product-led sale. So again, it sounds like you've also experienced very much what's like how do you upsell to larger organizations for scale, right? And that was also one of my big takeaways here. And we've tried several paths, right? So we've done outbound sales to organizations that fit our like ICP, and we've done product-led sales, so at least outreaching to product qualified leads that are better, obviously. And one of the best indicators for product qualified leads have been individuals that also fulfill kind of a marketing qualified lead. So type of organization, type of email, yada, yada, thing that then completed the extended trial. Those are like super yummy leads that helps us enter an organization and upsell there.
Fantastic. Rafa, did you want to share any insights or learnings from this past year, any experiments you guys were doing on growth?
Sure, happy to. So I think one of our biggest initiatives was exactly like, I have around 12 months on the belt now going to this team version, launching like a first offering and then sort of like iterating from there. Because initially we were really like seeing like a lot of churn because it was like credit card users, like just swiping and using the product. And, you know, we actually managed to unlock sort of the sort of motion that is free user, single pro user, and then like essentially becoming sort of the billing admin of like a larger team, assisting that with some product-led sales on top. And now it's, I think, 60 or 70% of our monthly added MRR. And like the biggest learning is like it automatically almost fixes your churn problem, you know, like if you focus on that. And like, so the main thing we've done is really focus on product value. Like we didn't obsess over like anything related to how to reach out. Like we literally send, and I swear it's true, if you visit our pricing page and you're not upgrading 7 days later, we send you an email like wondering if you like need a larger deal and we can give you some discounts based on the size of the deal. And that's how we run our product at sales. Like that's it. Like it's just a that simple email flow. And it works pretty well. Like I'm sure we can optimize, but this helped us sort of like see if the product motion is going in the right direction. And that's one of the biggest learnings. And yeah, I think it's like we're a bit fortunate because our product is very much a team product. And I could see that with Jacob's product as well. I'm not so sure about Bardeen, like I'm not too deep into this. But my one like big learning is like giving a feeling of control to the leads of the team is really, really important when thinking about moving to the team. Like they, like if they feel in control over everything that their team is doing, and then that's a really powerful upgrade driver.
And who's doing the product-led sales? Have you started bringing in actual sales teams, or is it still being led by either product or customer success?
Yeah, for us, it's Carlo. Like he's just the best listener on the team by far. And he's just really good at this. And then we have an advisor that helps us like figure things out as we go. Yeah.
Yeah, and on our side, it's myself and our chief growth officer, Chaska, that's doing most of the actual sales.
Yeah, I'm always curious about when teams and SaaS companies are ready to hire that first salesperson. Usually, I've seen founders try to do it too early. And if you haven't been doing it, and the founder needs to perfect that sales pitch before they can hire a salesperson. But then eventually, that gets to the point where if things are going well and you want to scale up, you got to start bringing in folks to specialize in that.
One quick comment on that, because I think you hear that super often. Oh, you need to learn the playbook and then you can handle those and stuff. I think there's also a ton of product learning in doing the sales, especially to larger organizations in the earlier days, that will be lost if it's salespeople that take over too early. So it's not just, hey, you need to perfect the growth motion. It's also like, well, you lose touch with your users, and especially those who really like those significant users that you want to sell to, you lose touch with that if you hand it over to Red.
Yeah, absolutely. Like basically from these conversations, we essentially designed our like 6 months sort of product roadmap. Like literally it was like almost like the Autobahn, you know, like we would take these conversations and we would like ship these things. I fully agree. Like, I think that's the most important thing at the early stages of that. And it's ideal if you can do this in-house, for sure. Yeah. Be like before hiring someone new. Yeah.
100%. So I think you know that I am getting back into the arena and going on a founder's journey, building. Any advice for me? You guys have been at this for a few years now in your current roles and your current companies. What's one piece of advice that I should take away as a founder starting out new startup?
Manage your energy ruthlessly. It's got to be so big ups and downs, and it's got to be a freaking long journey. And like, if you don't somehow establish methods for managing your energy early on, then it's going to be very, very rough.
Any specific things that have worked for you in doing that?
Perspective. It sounds stupid, right? But just the number of things that you can do to get perspective and make sure you're not your business. All of this advice, it's super like run-of-the-mill advice, but it really freaking works if you're able to do that. I think one of the ways that I've very concretely done that is I have a coach and I speak with them every freaking week, and that's super helpful.
Awesome. Yeah.
I think it's also like, especially like first few months for me was really like, I mean, I think there's two things. Like, A, it's really important to get feedback from other people as you're kind of thinking about your idea and kind of trying to really figure out what to do. But then on the other hand, like, don't like over index on that. Like, I think there's a lot of people that will just tell you because maybe your pitch of it wasn't great or you have failed to communicate certain things or whatever, but like they will give you false feedback. Or just because their data is different to your data, or they don't actually understand what they're talking about, or like many different reasons, right? But like they will tell you to do something that maybe you shouldn't be doing. And maybe sometimes it's better, especially if you're building your own company, it's better to stick with your own intuition over other people's intuition, because at the end of the day, you're going to be the one spending your next N number of years doing this. Not them, right? Like they don't have skin in the game. So it's very cheap advice to get from people. But sometimes I see founders, especially early stages, they like massively over index on industry expert XYZ's feedback. And then, you know, a few months later, they realize that they were wrong, but now they're not excited about what they're building anymore because it's not what they wanted to build, but what this other person wanted to build. And I think that's maybe something that's hard. You have to find a balance, right? Because you don't want to just like put your blinders on and completely ignore people's feedback, because sometimes there's very valid points in there and sometimes it's very good advice that you're getting and you should absolutely consider it. But I think there has to be a very strong filter that you yourself put there, and you're like, okay, how much do I want to listen to, you know, Raf's feedback on Teams go-to-market motion versus figure this out myself? Way I think is the right thing to do, because ultimately you're the one building the company and you're the one kind of like, you know, as you said, in the arena, and like Raf is just a, you know, sorry for like calling it's like the first one on the screen. So
but actually I fully agree with this point. Like there is some advice that I've gotten a lot of times and we did the opposite, and I'm like, every time I hear it now, I'm like chuckling because it works so well for us. I'm like, please keep giving this advice so fewer people like actually do the opposite, and then it works better for us. So like, yeah, I think there's so many things. Like you must run pricing and packaging experiments all the time. Like, no, we didn't run a single one last year. We still 5x our revenue. Like we will eventually run these experiments for sure. But like, you know, I don't need to do everything that someone tells me. Like fully, I agree. And my other point was, like, I never blindly trusted in compounding, like about things compounding. Like I always, like, just do things, don't scale. Like I heard it 10,000 million times, and I still felt shitty to personally craft emails to some prospects to try our shitty product, you know? So in that sense, it was like definitely for me, like an aha moment to like really blindly trust it, because it gives you peace while executing at the start, that eventually things will go their way. Yeah.
Got it. So ignore everybody's advice except for Rafa's. Love it. Let's look ahead. 2024, we're off to a fresh start. What is one thing that you are most excited about or looking forward to? And what's one prediction or wild forecast that you have for the year? Rafa, if you want to go first, then we'll go to Pascal and then Jacob.
Good question. Yeah, well, I think that products will start entering the phase of like a more general, like crossing the chasm sort of like nature, and will have to focus on specific use cases to really nail activation, to really nail then sort of the repetitive motion of that. We see that with Copy AI now. Like I really recommend following their journey at the moment. It's super interesting what they do. And so I think we will see a lot of that, and what seems to be competitors now might really not seem to be competitors in 6 months, 9 months, 10 months. So that's one really exciting thing. And as Pascal said at the beginning, like rising tide lifts all boats, like in that sort of light, I really think we'll see a lot of growth this year, especially with like the interest rates developing.
Cool.
Yeah, I think for me, I mean, I agree with what Ralph said. I think for me, it's mostly kind of like fundamental innovation and the acceleration of things because of AI and large language models. I think like the most exciting, we talked about risks and dangers and regulation a lot. I think one thing we haven't talked about before that to me is the most exciting thing is that like these language models are a tool to accelerate innovation, right? Like, and this is true for many other fundamental technologies we're dealing with today. But I think this in particular will increase the speed at which we can understand new things, comprehend new things. It makes us massively more creative, both in the like, you know, creative arts, writing, but also on a scientific point of view, it'll help us design experiments faster, write code faster. Like so many things will get faster. And I think that kind of like fundamentally creates this exponential growth across all technologies that I think is just like massively exciting to witness and kind of be in the, you know, be part of this game and see how that plays out over the next year, two, three, four, 5 years. I think we'll, you know, if we look back, I think it's already true. If we look back this year to 2020, for example, beginning of the pandemic, I could not have predicted like the world that we're in today. And I think, you know, and most of the experts I've talked to, like they also kind of were massively off with their predictions. And I think like this will only accelerate. And I think it's super exciting to like not really know what's going to happen and just see. And I think in particular about like fields of AI, but then also like applications of AI in biotech, medicine. Like there's now talks about the first cancer drugs being developed by AI. I think like so many material sciences, construction, like there's so many, obviously productivity. We all work in the productivity field, so obviously biased with that. But even outside of that, there's going to be so many cool applications, and it's just like amazing to see what's going to happen. So.
You guys, I had to follow. No, so in terms of what I'm looking forward to, I mean, Butter was not a native AI product from the beginning, as opposed to, I guess, say both of you guys. We've been baking AI deeper and deeper into the product where it made sense. And for us, it was like, whoa, suddenly a whole new solution space was opened up to us last year, right? And that's something I'm really excited about. We have a lot of things and we're working on stuff that, but we only want to make stuff that makes sense, right? So it's not like we throw an entire roadmap into it. So I'm very excited about the things that we're working on at the moment and hope that they will be as transformational as I think they can be. Well, in general, to the world of video conferencing. In terms of predictions for 24, I think I was very happy to see some of the interest rate developments. I was very sad to see that those interest rate developments were US-centric and not Euro-centric. I think that there's still enough uncertainty in the market for at least the first half year to make it very chaotic from a from both a fundraising perspective, of course, but also from a, like, again, we depend on B2B SaaS spend, so from B2B SaaS spend perspective, but I do believe and hope that things will start to lighten up towards the H2 of 24.
Amazing. Gentlemen, I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much. If there's any question that I didn't ask that you wished I'd asked, or if you want to ask a question to your fellow panelists, anything to add before we close it out?
I have one for you guys. Are you planning to, like, given that, like, the VC world is also kind of, the model is tumbling a little bit, like, are you planning to raise, this year?
Like, the two questions in that, right? Are you planning to raise at all because of the tumbling model, or are you planning to raise now? I'd say, like, we're pushing as far as we can because of the uncertainty, both in terms of multiples, et cetera. I do think that fundamentally, like, we're a VC-backed style business that needs VC money to grow to the size that we believe that we can become. So that being said, like, I will for quite a bit of time, and already now we're taking in alternative ways of funding. That's helpful instead of simply only VC funding, and we're relying very much on cash and revenue and low costs. So.
Yeah, I think that's a tricky question for me. I think we've recently done a very strategic investment with HubSpot that really wasn't planned. I don't really plan on fundraising right now. I think there's a number of factors which we talked about right now that make it not the most favorable environment. And I think there's a very good practice also in staying focused on just growing the business and not necessarily massively overbuilding the company where you don't really have the revenue to back it and so on. So that we're following. So that's really like our perspective. Having said that, there's always opportunities, and there's always like, you know, if the right thing comes together, then, you know, I think we're all venture-backed companies. So like you would take, you know, at least consider a deal if it makes sense, but we're not like actively looking for it at this point.
Yeah, that definitely seems to be the trend in focusing on growing revenue, keeping burn as low as possible to extend runways. Because those later rounds are much more difficult these days. Yeah, go ahead, Jacob. Sorry.
Yeah, no worries. So this whole PLG is dead thing, I don't really get it, and I don't see it. Are you guys like worried about this trend, or do you take any? Have you taken any big takeaways from that talk that is out there?
I think there's a. I think we talked about this last time on the podcast, actually. Like there's a lot of very poorly executed PLG strategies that are just like lazy growth strategies that have a not good product, but also don't want to build a sales team or can't raise the money to build a sales team and so on. And then they call themselves PLG and they fail. I don't know. I think it's the same thing is true. You know, like most startups fail, yet here we are building companies, you know, like I think it's always generic advice, and that you always have to find your own version of it. I think there's something to be learned from every company that fails in this sector, and there's something that we can all, you know, in every specific example, look at and understand, like, why did they fail? What can we learn from this? What can we do better? But I think just because some fail at doing it doesn't mean it's impossible to scale it. And there's great examples out there that have successfully scaled PLG motions, you know, Notion, Calendly, you name it. Like, I think I would look at those and say, like, okay, like, if it's dead, like, how come Notion is such a big successful company? Like, that just makes no sense to me.
Yeah, same. I feel like there's a lot of people that just position themselves as, like, the one extreme or the other to pull people over where things are not working. And they're like, ah, yeah, exactly. It's because this is not working. And you know, it's just, no, I really believe it is working. Like, for us, we're not planning to change it. And even if the whole industry changes now, because, like, some people are really dooming and glooming this, better for us, you know, like, I think there's a specific type of people that really like flocks towards PLG. And when you make sure that they see the value in your product, you make sure that they get the aha moment, they retain, you know, you can actually exploit like this value by going into the company and like showing this value to much more people based on that. When you succeed with that, PLG, I think, is the most cost efficient way to grow, but it's hard. Yeah.
Insert the blank is dead is the most overused kind of hot take that people want to throw out there. I'll just add something that I've observed, that people seem to forget that PLG still requires marketing or awareness on top of it, right? Product-led growth helps for activation and adoption, but they need to hear about it somehow. So if you're like TLDV and really Bardeen and Butter have similar kind of virality loops in the product. That's a best case scenario where you can have inherent growth in the product. But even with that, you still need to think about awareness. You need to think about whether it's demand generation or at least demand capture, all of that stuff to get them to the product, and then the product can take over. So that's one thing that I've would add there. This has been fantastic, but I want to be respectful of your time. And I know it's late where you are, so I want to let you go. Thank you to each of you. Really enjoyed this. Maybe we'll make an annual tradition of this to check in with each other and see how we're doing. But really enjoyed our conversation, learning from each of you, both now and in the first time we spoke. So thank you. Much appreciated, and wishing you tons of success in 2024 and beyond. Happy New Year.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Happy New Year, everyone.
Yeah, thanks so much. Happy New Year, guys. Bye.
New Year's, bye.
That's a wrap. Let me know your thoughts on this style show with a quick email at hello@pmfpod.com or DM me on LinkedIn or X. I always love to hear from you. And if you enjoyed it or took away any learnings, I'd greatly appreciate a positive review on Apple Podcasts or just share this episode with a friend. Wishing you rocket ship success on your startup journey. Bye for now.